Okay, today is Monday, March 9th, 2015, and Baruch Hashem, we're in the midst of beautiful spring weather here in the Holy City. In relation to the Shiurim, once again I got some very interesting correspondence on Malachim, and this is from my Talmud Nachum Shmaier, who's Sajrak, who just became engaged. It should be Lakesha Shel Kayama or Binyana Dayad. And he too writes about the Malachim, and he says that his impression was that the problem with their tzitzit was not that the tzitzit was sticking out, but they wore the entire beged on top of their shirt. In addition, I believe that they did not do all this privately, but they were leading a revolution that caused them to be thrown out of Torah Vadas. I think it's overstating it. I wouldn't say they were leading a revolution, but there's no question from the written and in other words, whatever scholarly apparatus we have left today, because the original research was done 60 plus years ago, there's no question that it was a move on to make Torah Vadas frumma. And considering who Mr. Mendelovich was and where he was coming from, what America was like in late 20s, early 30s, I'll accept the word revolution in that context. And then he makes a point that I think is very worthwhile. If you recall, I introduced the lectures on Hasidut by quoting from Jewish Action and the article on Neo-Hasidus. I would like to make another point. I do not think one can compare Malachim of then and Neo-Hasidim of now. Malachim were more involved in what they call frumkeit than Hasidic gefil. He means Hasidic feeling, gefil Yiddish. They had Hasidic gefil, but they were be'ikah trying to be machmir atorah liyoshna, to return the dress and the lifestyle to what was and their understanding of things. The Neo-Hasidim are looking for meaning and varimkeit more than trying to go, let me correct this English, more than trying to going back to what they think is the way Judaism was lived in olden times. And that point may be very well taken, that what you have today in seeking Hasidus, anyone can walk around with a tzitzit out, anyone can wear white and black, anyone can have a beard and payas today, no one will look askance as you. But what the Neil Hasidim, I think it's what I described yesterday. Shabbos morning I got home from shul a little after 8, I made kiddush, I started to learn. It was my greatest hana'ah. Within minutes, a Gemara and a Rambam open in front of me, and I get lost in a different world. My wife, I wake her up when I get home. She goes to Yakar, and she got home after 12. And I said, how can someone daven so long? They started at 8:15, they finished after 12. Oh, they were singing everything. The younger rabbi, there are many rabbis there. It's a whole family, the Rosen family. The younger rabbi was davening so beautifully, he loves to sing, and my wife is all inspired, and she said they were standing room only. And yes, this is a little bit different than a litvak. And it could very well be that this move to Neir Hasidut, which is felt at YU and felt, I would say, in Israel as well, in the Chardalim and the Rebbe that we have today in Gilo, And it could very well be that Nachum Shmayahu was absolutely right, that it's different than the Malachim, but nevertheless, halacha lemaisa, it's a return to Hasidic tradition in contemporary context. Okay, so with that being said, let me pick up where we left off last week. So what we spoke about last week, we spoke about the Rebbe's early years, we spoke about his relationship with his brother, the youngest brother, and there's no question that these early years had a formative influence upon the Rebbe. He was raised in a community where they were caught up with the tremendous problems of the times, the Zionism and the Bolshevikism and ultimately the communism and everything that went on, and the Rebbe is growing up with a great father, with a great mother, with, on one hand, tremendous tradition, On the other hand, willy-nilly, ala pova chamato, whether he likes it or not, he's being exposed to the bigger world beyond. And let me pick up with more memoir. I introduced the book of Larger Than Life by Rav Shimon Deutsch, the Lyoshner Rebbe, and I explained what I find so valuable in that volume, or in those two volumes, is that he did some very basic research and came up with a lot of memoir literature. And memoir literature does not lie. You can agree or disagree on facts, you can say they didn't do their research, but as far as the impression that people speak about, this is his impression, this is her impression. It gives you a feeling of what is happening. Now, let's come back. I'm in the middle of Larger Than Life. Let's come back to the Rebbe's youngest brother, Rebbe Yisrael Aryeh Leib, and this is the third brother. The middle brother, as we said, was born challenged, and the Rebbe and his youngest brother had a very unique relationship. Now, the younger brother, as we mentioned, first becomes a Zionist and later becomes a Bolshevik, becomes a supporter of what later takes over Russia, the Communist Party. And the rabbi, or the rabbi who ran the enlightened high school in this community, which was, we could compare perhaps to a certain degree to Talmudical Academy of Yeshiva University, it was both religious, it was open, it had general studies, it had Zionism. So the rabbi meets the rabbi of the school. His name is Rabbi Brustein. Rabbi Brustein meets the Rebbe's father, Reb Levi Yitzchak, the Shtuk Rav, and he says to him, "I feel very bad. I feel labriyut. I feel pain. I've lost my top Talmud. Is no longer has become a Bolshevik follower." And the father of the Rebbe, and the father of the boy they're talking about, Label, says, "I too feel much pain, but I felt that pain already when he became a Zionist." So it shows you some of the tension that you have in the atmosphere. Now, in 1924, the Rebbe's younger brother began to attend the University of Leningrad, and he lived what appears to be a dual existence, a schizophrenic existence. During the week, he would be at the university, and Shabbos, he would stay with the sixth Rebbe, Rebbe Yitzchak Yosef, who was then in Leningrad, then in what we call today Petrograd or Petersburg. At one time, it was called St. Petersburg. Under the communists, it was called Leningrad. And that's where the sixth Rebbe was located. And here, his distant relative would stay with him for Shabbos, with Davin and the Shtibble, with mix with the Hasidim. And the Hasidim loved Label because he had a phenomenal memory and could discuss any subject ranging from Hasidus to mathematics. And Deutsch writes, and I cite him, and I think his take is correct, Label was in sense of contradiction. Although while in Russia he still wore a yarmulke and even learned Hasidus, his world was quite different. And while in Leningrad he studied under a very famed mathematician, S.S. Vasilev, and even co-authored a paper with his professor that dealt with physics and electricity, and this paper received acclaim. The previous Rebbe tried to influence him, but Label remained Label. Well, obviously, during this period, he observed outwardly, certainly, to be with the Rebbe, to be there Shabbos. He wore a yarmulke. He observed. There's no question that at this period, he observed. Now, later, Label is disillusioned by the Bolshevikism. He becomes a Trotskyite. And all of you know that Stalin starts to crack down on dissidents, and Label has to get out. And what happened was Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, his father, had a friend, Mordechai Guraye. Mordechai Guraye had grown up with Leibel's father in Lubavitch, and he had a terrible accident. He drowned while swimming. In those days, passports had no pictures. So Leibel, who was worried that he could never leave Russia with the Schneerson name because they were too well known, and the government watched them very carefully, Leibel took his father's friend's passport. Since it didn't have a picture, he got out using that passport. For the rest of his life, Leibel adopted that name, and that was the name he used, Mordechai Guraye, or Mark Guraye. What's very interesting is, and we'll come to this, all of you know that the previous Rebbe's eldest son-in-law was a Guraye, and that was the name that Leibel used, so that there evidently was a family connection as well, and he was very comfortable being Mordechai Guraye, Mark Guraye, and not being Leibel Schneerson. You don't have to be a great psychologist to be able to analyze this as well. When you reject your family name and even your first name, this already is a sign of rebellion. It's not just you're taking on a new name, you're rejecting a lifestyle, you're rejecting a background, you're rejecting your parents, you're rejecting tradition. And I've seen it and I've been part of it. As long as one walks the face of the earth, this stares you in the eyes. In my wife's family, there were two sisters that came to the United States. I don't know if they were born in America, born in Europe, came immigrants, became Americanized, totally rejected any tradition, ad kidei kach, that they didn't sit shiva for their parents when their parents died. And they changed their first names. That tells you something. Ad kidei kach, not just the family name, not just the foreign name, but your first name, which is yours, which you recognize from the time you're 6 months old. Ask someone who does medical research. A little kid in the crib already recognizes his name, and you reject it. Anyone coming in Aliyah, I need not tell you, many times I was asked, how did I change my name? Isn't it offensive to your father? And yes, there is some truth to it, that you change your name. It is slightly offensive. In my case, it was not overwhelming for one simple reason. I had only daughters. I never dreamt I would have so many grandsons and great-grandsons, but I had only daughters, so the name would not live on, so I told that to my father. But what actually happened with my father, I apologize for telling you the story, but it's a cute story. My father was a little upset, and one time he was at the Colton, there was a big line trying to get in, and my father jumps to the head of the line, and the guy on guard, it was a period before now, was Haga. Anyone here remember Haga? When you came in, Charlie, when you came in. So when we came in Aliyah, there was Haganah Artsit. It was people who didn't do regular army, or people who were finished with army, they pushed you into there, you slept at home. That was the difference. So it was easier for the army, less expensive. And they did a lot of the guard duty. Today, it's all part of the army. Haggad doesn't exist. If you go and watch Azulai HaShoter, if you're privileged to watch that movie, which is a classic, you'll see the movie begins with people on patrol. They're in the Haggad uniform. They're playing the role that they're in Haggad. So this guy is on Haggad, and my father goes over. He speaks to him in English, and it's an American. It's someone from Bnei Akiva, from the old country, from Brooklyn. And he says to my father, there's a line here. He says, well, maybe you know my son. And the guy, what do you mean I know your son? He says, my son is Harav Rakefet. Harav Rakefet. The guy salutes him and pushes my father through. My father told me at that moment he made total peace with the name Rakefet. But to be slightly serious, I write about it in Washington, when you're a Baal Tshuva, you have to change your name. I quote the Rambam, Hilchot Tshuva, to show you that it's like the communist system. When you went bankrupt and you started all over again, you had to change your name to show you are not the Klein of old. You are now Mr. Gross, big, not small. So when you become an Aliyah, you become a Baal Tshuva. Baal Tshuva has to change his name. So I justify it in Washington. But the Rebbe's brother changed his name. It's fascinating. It fits right in with their relationship with the Rebbe's brother, with the Rebbe's brother understanding, and all that happened in life. Now, coming back to the Rebbe, while all this is happening, his brother developing interest in mathematics, conquering the world, leaving the narrow world of Torah, the Rebbe is exposed to exactly the same influences. He too is broad, he too is interested in science, he too is interested in mathematics, has a special interest in astronomy, but the Rebbe is learning day and night. And he is his father's not only most devoted child, but his father's most devoted disciple. And here's a bit of a Hasidic story, but evidently Deutsch takes it as a fact, and it's revealing. The Reb Shalom Dov Be'er had a famous Hasid, Reb Eliezer Nanas. If you talk to old-time Lubavitchers, they'll tell you stories about Reb Eliezer Nanas. He was a Hasid of Reb Dov Be'er. Reb Shalom Dov Be'er, that was the fifth Rebbe. I believe he also served Reb Yosef Yitzchak, the sixth Rebbe. And in 1918, the fifth Rebbe, who was a Gaon Adir, by the way, Reb Shalom Dov Be'er, they say that his sikhot, that this is what I'm told by experts in Hasidus, that there's unbelievable depth to his thinking. And he was a leader at a time of revolution and World War I and all that went on. And he sent Reb Lezer Nanas to visit his cousin, Reb Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, the Rebbe's father, in his community to bring him a message from the Rebbe. Whatever that message is, we don't know. When he arrived at the Schneerson home, Reb Lezer Nanas related, he was greeted by Reb Levi Yitzchak. He sat, spoke to the Rebbe's father, spoke to Reb Levi Yitzchak. I got to be careful how I speak, because we're talking about many different Rebbeim. He's speaking to Reb Levi Yitzchak. He noticed that close by, in a side room, a young man was studying very seriously. It was the Rebbe, Reb Menachem Mendel. The Rebbe's father noted the interest shown by Reb Eliezer Nanas in his diligent son and remarked to him, quote, "Observe and remember him well. It will be advantageous to you." Years later, Rabbi Nanas was sentenced to 20 years of hard labor in Siberia for the crime of strengthening religious education in Russia. In 1950, when the previous Rebbe passed away, we're talking about now the sixth Rebbe, Reb Levi, we're talking about the Riyats, Reb Yitzchak Yosef, Reb Yosef Yitzchak. Rabbi Nanas was still imprisoned in Siberia. He was told of his Rebbe's death by a cruel Nachalnik. Do you recognize the word? What does it mean? Nachalnik. Camp supervisors, the way he translates it. We have a native Russian speaker here. And by the way, the same story was told by other people in labor camp. Yosef Mendelovich and others have similar stories when Stalin died and when a great religious person died and the way the news was brought to them, Stalin is before, let go after Stalin. But what you and this camp supervisor said to him, "You may now give up your beliefs since your leader, the man that you are hoping to see, is not alive anymore." At that moment, Rabbi Nanas recalled his visit to Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, and without hesitation responded, quote, "But his son-in-law," meaning the Rebbe, Reb Menachem Mendel, "is alive." And it's a fascinating little Hasidic story, But it shows you that the father already sensed that this son, his eldest son, the great Matmid, sitting and learning, that one day he would really bring salvation to the Jewish people, to the Hasidic people, Bifrat to the Lubavitcher people. Okay, now let me go a step further. We'll come back to the relationship between father and son and come back to the early years of the Rebbe in about 20 minutes. But I want to zero in with all this learning. It's very, very fascinating, the similarities between the Rav Mori Rebbe and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Tell me, I want to ask you a question. How many of you know from whom the Rav got smicha from? Now, that's an interesting question. Eli, what do you say? His grandfather? Absolutely not. No. So you see, everyone can answer, where did Rakefet get smicha? Well, what's the big deal? You open up a YU publication, you'll see 61. I have another smicha, but smicha YU, fine. Where did Yitz Rubin get smicha? YU, what was it, 62, 63? When did you get smicha, Yitzchak? 63. But you're only a year younger than me, I want you to know. The reason you got 63 and I got 61 is because we were a grandfather clause. You know what I'm talking about? In our time, they changed the smicha program to 3 years instead of two. So some of us protested loud and clear, and they made a deal with us. If we went into the Rav when we were juniors in college, we could get smicha at the end of 4 years with the Rav. So I was part of the grandfather clause. I got smicha 61, although with the new regulations, I should have gotten in 62. Why were we in such a rush? Because in those days, there was no kollel. You wanted to get married, you had to make a living, you had to go to work, you had to go into the rabbinate, you had to get shecht, you had to get killed. So you were in a rush to get out there and do what you had to do. Baruch Hashem. So everyone knows where we got smicha. Tell me, where did Lubavitcher Rebbe get smicha? So you see, we can guess from today to tomorrow, you got to really do your research to come up with the answers. I can tell you where the Rav got smicha. It's not important now. But when the Rav wanted to leave for Berlin, his father collected a few smichot for him. And the most important one, the one we know about for sure, the one that's been published in Harpades, which I spoke about yesterday, was the one from Rav Avram Dovbeck, Kahana Shapiro, the Kovna Rav. And Dafka Rav Chaim Isaac Grzynski was very hesitant and probably very upset because the Rav was going on a course that did not meet his approval, namely leaving Eastern Europe to go to Germany to study for a PhD at the University of Berlin. That was not exactly a cup of tea for the leaders of Agudat Yisrael, the Litvish Jewry leaders, the Rashi Yeshiva. It was a bitter pill for them to swallow, and they still haven't been able to digest that pill until today, some 114, 15 years later. So you got to do your research. You got to do your research, and it's no big deal, because the truth of the matter is, who needs smicha? Torah goes by learning. We don't have a Sanhedrin today. We don't have a Beis Din Haggadah. When you see the movie, I just saw the movie again this morning. You almost sent me another version of it with all the names right there, so you can follow the names as the Gedolim walk in to attend the Knesiyah Gedolah in 1923. And I still shiver and shake when I see the Chafetz Chaim. Knew that the Chafetz Chaim had smicha. Chafetz Chaim never even had smicha. You know when he finally got smicha? When after World War I, when the Polish government announced a discount for clergy to use the railroad and the whatever, the trolleys, the trams, so they told the Chafetz Chaim he has to get smicha so he would qualify for the discount because he has to meet the Chaim Meister, he has to travel occasionally. So that's when people gave the Chafetz Chaim smicha, he should be able to qualify for the discount. So smicha is not that important when a person knows shas and paiskim backwards and forwards, knows kol haTorah kula. What does he need smicha for? So the story of the Rebbe's smicha is very fascinating, and here I have a special role in the story because I actually heard it from the person involved who was publicized. That I'll give you all the sources in a few minutes, but let me give you the background, let me give you the story, because it's precious. And again, it reveals the Rebbe, because books have been written about the Rebbe, we'll come to it, Friedman and Heilman. And if you're familiar, I've read every book that came out on the Rebbe. Not that I, at that point, when I started reading, it was years ago, I wasn't interested and didn't dream I would give lectures on the Rebbe's life. It's only when I got involved with the history of Torah in America that how can you talk about the history of Torah through 1960 without dealing with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But if you read some of the books, particularly Friedman and Heilman, I read it in Hebrew, but it's in English. I think originally came out in English before the Hebrew. So you get the feeling the Rebbe was running away, like he was going to Berlin. He's running away from Hasidus. He's running away. Who knows what's going to be with him, what he's going to do in life. The Rebbe, you can describe his general learning as much as you want and his general knowledge as much as you want. But one thing we all know, when he came to the United States in 1941, he knew Kol HaTorah Kula Baal Peh. And you don't get that by osmosis, because the angel indents your above your lip and you forget it all, even if you knew it before. There's a lot to say in that. It's not for now. Rafi, don't get me started now to give a drasha on what that Gemara means. I have a lot to say. It's a very important Gemara. Very, very important. That's why I have a theory that when you meet these people who convert, you meet people tzaddikim, and you wonder, what brought you to Yiddishkeit? And I always feel there's some great-great-grandparents who were Jewish, and never what happened in the course of life, but that ability to live Torah is passed on to them. The whole concept that the angel teaches you means that just as our body has the ability to digest food, just as our body has the ability to function, just as our minds think, and all that goes into a human being, it also means a Jew was taught by the angel, his body is capable of observing Torah. It's not too difficult for us. It's not distant. It's not beyond us. And somehow, generations later, those genes come out and they direct descendant, and they don't know why. They're attracted to Yiddishkeit. They're attracted to Torah. They see greatness in Torah. They see great Torah people. They don't let the scandals pull them down, all that we have to read about and hear. Shem Yerachem. So that's my theory. So the angel hits you, you forget it all. You don't have a cleft palate, it's gone. But you get it by study, the Rebbe knew Kol HaTorah Kula. Now, the story of the smicha is fascinating. Berlin, following World War I, until almost World War II, we could say until World War II, basically, the late 30s, Berlin became a magnet for the Torah world that sought to thrive outside of the ghetto. Berlin was the most enlightened city. At times, the Rav used to be overwhelmed when he spoke about this. Who could believe what would come out of Berlin to kill every man, woman, and child, to do what Haman, and to succeed? Where Haman failed, they succeeded. But Berlin, it became the heartthrob of anyone that had Torah learning and wanted to go beyond. Berlin was the place. Now, in Berlin, you had the what I spoke about many years ago in great detail when I spoke about the history of Torah in modern times. You had the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary. The Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary, began by Israel Hildesheimer, 1873, was a German institution where the training was in the spirit of Chachmat Yisrael. Jared, do you know what I mean by Chachmat Yisrael? Scientific Jewish scholarship. Have you ever been exposed to it? Have you taken courses? Bernard Revel, you know what I'm talking about? It's interesting. One day, go into a class in Bernard Revel, if they teach Talmud, and listen to that Rebbe's shir, and compare it to the way you would hear the shir in Gris Kol. You follow? It's a different approach. It can be frum, it can be magnificently frum. Many of the rabbeim in Lithuania, their wives didn't cover their hair, and every rebbe, every malamed, every professor in Hildesheim, their wives wore shekels. I'm not commenting on the frum kind, but it certainly was an absolutely different approach. Alex Glassman would be very enthralled by comparing Berlin to Washington Heights, YU, to Crown Heights 770. It's three different worlds, basically, although it's all part of the same world. Now, what's fascinating is World War I. Now, who can tell me, who can fill me in World War I, the German Jews fought for the Kaiser. They believed in Germany. They were good citizens. Because they had so many good German soldiers who were Jewish, they had a tremendous rap in it. Among the rabbis were Rabbi Dr. Joseph Kalbach. I believe he was a full colonel in the German army. There were members of the Kalbach family, beyond Rabbi Kalbach. They're just unbelievable. Rosnack, I believe he was a lieutenant colonel. These were all rabbanim trained in Hildesheim. Well, they got to Poland, they got to Lithuania, they're part of the German army, and they meet the Polish Jews, the Litvish Jews, and they're overwhelmed. They see these Jews, may not have sophistication and PhDs, but they have Yiddishkeit, they have Warmkeit, they have warmth, they have learning, they have knowledge, and they're overwhelmed. More than that, the soldiers who were Jewish were overwhelmed. And there's memoir literature of a slightly earlier period, Bernard Drachmann, where Bernard Drachmann is sent to Germany to study at the Breslau Seminary to be a semi-conservative reform rabbi. And it's paid for. He has a scholarship from America. And he visits Poland. He came from a wealthy family. His father sent the money to visit Poland. You know, you're traveling. Visit. And he's in an inn, and Siddish Jews are staying in this inn, and Drachman sees them benching on a Wednesday evening. He says they were benching with more kavana than we bench in Germany on Erev Yom Kippur. Okay? And the rest of the story, of course, I don't have to fill in. Drachman comes back to America, becomes one of the leading Orthodox rabbis in the United States, one of the founders of RCA, taught at YU, etc., etc. Bernard Drachman of Newark originally. So, Berlin now is not satisfied with just Yekkyism, with just scientific Jewish scholarship. And the Berlin Rabbinic Seminary, after Rav David Zvi Hoffman dies in 1924, they need, the students want, a Litvish Rebbe. And they were very fortunate because at that time in Berlin, there is an Ilui from the Slabatka Yeshiva world. He was considered the biggest Ilui in the Litvish Yeshiva world, early 1900s, Rebbe Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. And Alex, here you can read all about him in Making of a Gadol by Reb Nissen Kamenetsky. And you'll get a good feel of who Rebbe Chiel Yaakov Weinberg was. What was he doing in Berlin? Again, I've told you many times, he had a very tragic first marriage. He and his wife, who was a shidduch, put together by the Alta. It's one of the few times, Ellie, that the Alta of Slabatka failed. You know what I'm saying? He failed. Why did he make the shidduch? Because they were worried stiff that Rebbe Chiel Yaakov Weinberg had an interest in Russian language and second general knowledge, you follow me? So they figured, marry him off. Because generally speaking, if you had an interest beyond that mark, which is Torah and Shas and Paiskin, you could become an apikoros in those days. It was a different era. So marry him off young. They made a shidduch with the Plishvishki Rav's daughter. He had the Rav had just died, and that way, by marrying the daughter, he inherits the rabbinate. But it was a shidduch shelo ala yafeh. That she just was. She's nishkeven pasik fam. Do you understand a little mama lashon? No, she was. If I said it in Russian, you would understand, right? What can I do? Say it in Russian to him. Let's see if he understands. She was not. Pasik, it just didn't work. She married, you know, it look, you don't know whose fault it was. I'm not blaming her. I understand she married and happily married Baruch Hashem afterwards. He never remarried. But it was unheard of that a Litvish Talmud Chacham, a Rav, it's not today where you have Rabbanim in the pulpit, the rabbi in my sister-in-law's shul was married to my student, they got divorced, he now introduced his new wife to me, she was divorced. It's a different world today. You understand, in those days, a Rav, a Tavzich Opkiget, wow, it was scandalous. So he went to Berlin, got himself a doctorate, and he was in Berlin, and he became, again, I'm saying it very popularly, I don't want to be accused of being flippant, as Ami accused me, but I gave endless lectures, Mark on Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, weeks and weeks at end. Yitzhak Rubin was asleep already, he was so bored. So I know the topic, Baruch Hashem, my student Mark Shapiro, but to put it very popularly, he was a fabulous choice to head up the seminary in Berlin, a Gaon Adia, a Litvisher, a person who had absorbed Musa from the altar of Slabodka, and a PhD, and a scientific approach as well. The man embraced all. Okay. Now, anyone who came to Berlin, you had to have contact with the seminary, because let's say the Rav came to Berlin. Afterwards, the Lubavitcher Rebbe comes to Berlin. All these people, this was a lamp that attracted you, a lighthouse. So you went, you talked to learning, you spoke, you attended classes. The more correct word is you audited classes. I once used that word for Israelis who know English, but they didn't know what the word meant. They looked at me like I'm talking about bookkeeping. But auditing means, like Mark, you're not an official student. You're auditing, you come in, Baruch Hashem, great. Okay, now the Rebbe is in Berlin. The Rav is in Berlin. Can anyone tell me what the Rav got involved with in Berlin? Rakefet writes about it in a footnote. Rakefet's last eye-to-eye meeting with the Rav in 1983. I played around with Rebbe on this very involvement of his. No, yes, tell the class. His uncle asked him to look at manuscripts, the Berlin library, what they had in the Avodat HaMelech. Look into my footnote, I think I have 8 references where the Avodat HaMelech quotes the Rav checking out the Kitvei Yad in the Beit Eked Sfarim in Berlin. The Rebbe wanted to use the library. Ah, it seems in the library they had rules and regulations, and to get into the manuscripts, you had to show that you needed it for your scholarly purposes. What rabbis needed was to show rabbinical ordination. But you needed rabbinical ordination. Germany is Germany, from a recognized institution. Now, what Rafi, you said the Rocket Shava? You said it, right? We don't know for sure, but there is a Chabad tradition. We do know that the Rebbe corresponded with the Rocket Shava from Berlin. So there, and you have to understand, to correspond with the Rocket Shava, I had a Rebbe, should live in Buell, my only Rebbe who's alive, Rabbi Yosef Weiss. Rabbi Yosef Weiss once brought a card to class, a postcard he got from the Rocket Shava. It's a precious possession. The Rocket Shava was a Gaon Sheva Gaon. He was too big a Gaon. No one could comprehend him. You know the way he wrote, Vine, 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 Vine. And you had to figure out why he's quoting this Gemara. So it's true that Rebbe corresponded. Tradition has it that the Rebbe had smicha from the Rocket Shava. No one has ever seen that smicha. But that smicha would not help the Rebbe in the university. You know, so like, watch this, a postcard from some little shtetl in Riga, and in Latvia? Ah, so the Rebbe went to the Sridei Eish. And he said to the Sridei Eish, I'd like to get smicha from you. So the Sri Deyesh, who was caught between two worlds, a Litvisher and a Yeka, says to him, fine, come and study, pass all the exams, there are months of work to be done, I'll be happy to give you smicha. The Rebbe said, no, I need the smicha right away. So the Sri Deyesh said, no, we don't give smicha like that. So the Rebbe said, I'll make a deal with you. He evidently knew the Sri Deyesh was an Ilu. You see, Iluyim can play this game. Okay? So he says to the Sri Deyesh, you know what? Pick out a sefer that you feel has a lot of lumdus, and tomorrow morning give me a bechiner on the sefer and hear what I have to say. No, the Sri Deyesh hears an offer like that. Fine. Now, at that moment, the Sri Deyesh was involved in a very serious halachic problem. It's a problem that Germany was filled with. I lectured on this extensively in the years I devoted to the Holocaust, although this problem in the 20s into the early 30s was not motivated by anti-Semitism. It was a reality of Germany. What's the reality? Gentlemen, the Medrash says, when you see a cemetery, you know you've arrived at the city. Because cemeteries were built right outside the cities. So if you're a traveler, you're a wayfarer, and you're traveling and you're exhausted, and you see the cemetery, I'm there. I'll soon be able to get, what is that, zero that you love? I'll soon be able to get a bottle of zero coke. I'm near the city. You follow? Take a look. Queens, Main Street. Malka and I have all our grandparents, all eight, buried there. Malka has great grandparents buried there. Great, great grandparents buried there. That was the end of the world. Today, Main Street, Queens, is the heart of Queens, the heart of the Jewish cemetery. Right there on Main Street, with all the eateries, Minefs, Minfresh, Minchop, Magic Ice Cream, Pizza Places galore, Milchiks, Fleishiks, one block away, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews Ligin tiftaya in dread. No translation necessary. No, now I ask you. In Germany, it's not America. When the city expanded, they said, close down the cemetery, remove all the graves. We'll give you ground 20 miles from here. Rebury them. It's not anti-Semitism. It's a reality. The city is expanding. Okay? Now you come to the question. Can you disinter bodies? Can you disinter graves? Can you interfere with a cemetery? Can you interfere with the Beit Olam? And that was the problem that all the German Rabbanim had. No one was big enough, learned enough to give a proper answer. They turned to Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the rector of the Rabbinic Seminary of Hildesheimer, the Posek Achron of German Orthodoxy, and he wrote a tremendous chuntras on Pinui Atzamot. I'll give you all the sources in a few minutes. So Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, being a Litvisher, sees the smart aleck young man who dares to say to him, throw a sefer at me and tomorrow morning we'll talk in learning. He says, fine. He gives him the kuntris that he had just prepared on Pinui Atzamot. The Rebbe goes home. He eats his supper, davens Maariv, opens up the kuntris. I don't know if he stayed up all night, if he didn't have to stay up all night. The next day he meets with Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov, and he gives him backwards and forwards everything that he's written, and he'arot, and additions, and addendums, and critiques, and additional sources. And on the spot, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg gave the Rebbe smicha. Now, that is quite a story. So you have to ask yourself, Rakefet, we know you're not a chassid. We know you're a litvak. We know you have emotional tendencies. But Akan, you're sitting here in Yerushalayim and you're telling a story like that, and you expect Charlie Hexter, PhD, Harvard University, to believe it? Alex, good question. Absolutely. So now I'll tell you why you have to believe it. It's very simple. We Jews have no mazel. You don't want to believe me, it's an open Gemara in Shabbos. Ein mazal Yisrael. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov barely survived. What's your name? I see a...
Stephen Felsenthal.
Stephen? Felsenthal. Oh, Yekka Felsenthal. Wow, you came in almost to the right shear. We Jews, I'm also shtick, you know, I have six Yekki grandchildren, so I qualify. I actually tried to call one this morning. He must be learning. I'm a little surprised because his phone won't take any calls. My wife, he's in Rabbi Steinsaltz's Hesder, where from 1:30 to 3:30 he becomes an orchestra. He plays the Saturday musical instruments. He's a different type of kid. Does movies, makes movies. So I want to reach him. My wife wants him. I don't want to catch you learning. Your job is to the saxophone and the movies, but I guess he didn't listen to that today because I couldn't get my call through. Back here. We Jews have no mazel. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg barely survived the Holocaust. It's what Hitler did to us, it's beyond comprehension. Why the Prime Minister didn't mention it, I'm told, is he was warned not to play that card. It's overplayed. All right, there may be some truth to it. I would have begun my talk stressing, he alluded to it, but stressing what we went through by not being realistic in the 30s and listening to Chamberlain instead of reality. By the way, just between the lines, I have to say, the Prime Minister deserves every accolation and every salute and every salutation in the world. If you're listening to the news yesterday, Obama was speaking a different language, the Germans are speaking a different language, and the French are speaking Netanyahu's language, word for word, including obviously Saudi Arabia. The man deserves every compliment in the world, but forget it, you can't win here. The anti-Netanyahu feeling is just overwhelming, and the website said it all. Did you see that that newspaper with the headline, you know, Yediyot Achronot, everything, the masthead, everything perfect, and screaming headlines, the snow did not fall because of Netanyahu. And boy, that says it all. Anyway, back here. So we have no mazel, and he barely survives the Holocaust. He is broken in spirit, broken in health, broken physically. There were rumors, by the way, that he went out of his mind. There's a whole literature on this. If you're interested, my student Mark Shapiro's doctorate at Harvard, you can get all the sources, but I knew about it even before Mark did the doctorate. He had a Talmud, Shaul Weingart. Shaul Weingart had married in, was part of the Butchko family in Monterey in Switzerland. He ran a yeshiva. It was a family yeshiva, Eitz Chaim, and he was a fairly well-off individual. They had a family business. I believe it was women's clothing. They took new money, no salary from the yeshiva, not his father-in-law, not him. And he invites his Rebbe to stay with him. They build him a mother-daughter relationship, if you know what I'm talking about, a regular house, and next to it a small little two-room deal. And they tell Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, this is your home for the rest of your life. You never have to worry. Iva l'moshevlo, we're happy to have you. And Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov starts to resuscitate and recoup. And Nebuch, 1 year later, 1946, 47, 1 year after arriving, his Talmud Mufak of Shaul Weingart is waiting for a trolley car, and he's run over and killed. The widow says to Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov, you remain with us. She had a number of children. One son, Rabbi Avram Abba Weingart, Rabbi Dr. Avram Avram Weingott, my dear friend, lives on Rehov Chernichovsky, married my first student I taught at Mechlala when I started teaching there, 71, the Israeli postgraduate program. She married a young lady at the time. Today they have a tribe. She lived across the street from us, actually, in Rehavia. And he grew up on the lap of Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. As Mark Shapiro says, and I'll give you a quote as well, he was the son that Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg never had. He devotes his life, besides teaching, he devotes his life to putting out his Rebbe's Svarim. You all have seen them, the new edition of the Sri Deyesh, La Prakim, Chidushim on Shas. This is all the work of Rabbi Dr. Avram Abba Weingott. Now, he tells this story. How did he know the story? Because in Switzerland there was a Hasidic Jew, the last name was Kowalski. You recognize the name, it's part of the Kowalski family. It was a Gerach Hasid. A Gerach Hasid. And he was very close to Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. Everyone gathered around Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg. He was the dominant Torah personality in Switzerland. Why he remained in Switzerland until today? We always ask that question, and there's the simple answer, but it may be the honest answer that Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg gave, half in jest, but quite seriously, that in Switzerland he's very much at home, no one bothers him. But if he goes on Aliyah, what does he do? If he goes to Slabodka Yeshiva, to Hebron, all the Hebrew University people will be mad at him. If he goes to Hebrew University, all the Slabodka Hebron Yeshiva people will be mad at him. And you all know in his death exactly what happened. The coffin was held up in the middle of the street, in the middle of Rehov Yafo. They fought back and forth, and Rav Chatzkel Sana, he was originally supposed to be buried in the Mizrahi area for the professors and the great enlightened Rabbanim in Sanhedria. And Rav Chatzkel Sana said, over my dead body, he put his cane on in front of him and said, we don't budge. And he ordered them to build the grave in Chelkat HaRabbanim at Har Menuchot. And that's where Rabbi Chil Yaakov is buried, so he remained in Switzerland. So one time Rabbi Kowalski says to Rabbi Chil Yaakov, why don't you correspond with the Lubavitcher Rebbe? He has such a great person in America doing so many great things. And Rabbi Chil Yaakov says, you have to tell me who the Lubavitcher Rebbe is? Let me tell you about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he tells Rabbi Kowalski this story, and Rabbi Kowalski repeats it to Avram Abba Weingott, word by word. And then Rabbi Chil Yaakov goes on and says, how can I correspond with him? If I correspond with him, I have to write. He's the greatest Hasidic Rebbe in the world today. I have to write all these titles. I'm his Rebbe. He used to audit my classes at the seminary. On the other hand, how can I not write to him and not use all these titles? So Shevi Al Tasa. Gentlemen, what are the sources? I'm going to make a small addendum in a minute, but a very, very fascinating story and absolutely true, word by word. Shele to Tshuva Sri Deyesh, I'm quoting from the Weingott edition. From the new edition, not the Mosar HaRav Kook edition, but the new edition. You can check back from the new edition. They give you a chart which enables you to find it in the original Mosar HaRav Kook edition. Look in to Choshen Mishpat, Siman Kuf Lamed, and then look into Sri Deyesh Yoredeya, beginning with Siman Kuf, and going all the way through Siman Kuf Tet. It's tens and tens of pages of responsa literature, the Kuntris on P Pinui Atzamat Hamet. Now, the whole story, as I have told it, with all the sources you will find in the latest volume to come out of Chidushei Baal Sridei HaEsh Al Shas, Chelek Yimel, beginning on page 27. It's the footnote at the bottom of page 27, and it carries through all of page 28. Okay? This is the Rebbe's Smicha. That's Berlin. That's the relationship with the Sridei HaEsh. Now, in parentheses, let me come back to something I said, I believe it was last week or 2 weeks ago. If you recall, one of the early shluchim the Rebbe sent out in the first shaluach that the seventh Rebbe sent out to really go far was Reb Itchid David Grona, sending him from Brooklyn to Australia. That is quite a trip. I have flown many, many hundreds of thousands of miles in my life, without exaggeration, for the sake of the Torah people. When I came in Aliyah, I never thought I would see America again. We didn't even fly. We came in Aliyah by boat. But God willed otherwise. The involvement with the Mossad became a springboard for activities for Russian Jewry. And then whenever I spoke, people would hear me speak and invite me to come be scholar in residence. And among the places I traveled to was Australia, which was the longest trip by far. Left here on a Chves on Monday and arrived in Australia finally on Wednesday. So they were going on Shlichut. Remember, the whole yeshiva came out to say goodbye to them, and the Rebbe stood at the door waving. Who else was with Reb Itchid David Grona? Remember, I mentioned another name. Someone flying with him at that time, not to Australia, but to Milano, Italy. Harav Gershon Mendel Grelick. You see the name, you see the hashgacha, the wine. I trust that it's still Reb Gershon Mendel who's still alive. If not, perhaps it's his son, but I constantly see the name Rabbi Grelick coming out of Milano, the name Hashgacha, Chabad, and all that goes with it. So on page 28, Rabbi Avram Abba Weingart tells an additional Hasidic story. Me inyan liinyan ba'oto inyan. So if we're talking about the seventh Rebbe, let me add this additional story, which is in parentheses, because it's, you know, we can go on with the Rebbe's life without the story, but it's a beautiful story which ties together the people we've just spoken about. So Reb Gershon Mendel Grelick winds up in Milano, the Rav in Milano, Chabad, there until today. The family is there, the accomplishment is there. And when he's a young rabbi in Milano, there's going to be a conference of all the Rabbanim in Europe. And the conference is being held in Switzerland so that Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg can attend. And he, by far, was the greatest Talmud Chacham left on European soil after World War II. Fine. And Rabbi Grelick now has built up a reputation for himself, and the rabbis running the conference invite Rabbi Grelick to be one of the speakers. Well, he's a relatively young man, and he's frightened stiff to be a speaker at a conference where the Sridei HaEsh is going to participate. So he contacts the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he tells the Rebbe he's invited to the conference. He's a little bit frightened. The Sridei HaEsh will be there. He wants a blessing from the Rebbe. So the Rebbe gives him a bracha, should be matzliach, And he tells him, I'll also give you advice on what sugya to talk about. Whatever the sugya is, we don't know. But he tells him, look at the sugya, develop it, give it a good talk on it. It'll be very appropriate for the rabbis in Europe. Vayechi hayom, the day comes, the conference is held, the conference begins, and finally, they call upon the Gadol Hadar, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, to speak, and he gets up, and he quotes and opens up exactly with the Gemara that Rabbi Gerelich had prepared. And Rabbi Gerelich felt, how do you feel, you know, they're stealing away your source, min ganvet v'maych, you're going to speak, but you're speaking afterwards, and here the Gadol Hador is speaking on the very Gemara you want to speak, and Rabbi Chil Yaakov starts warming up, and suddenly he doesn't feel well, and he excuses himself. It's like the story I told yesterday with the Baal Korei and Ol Rivka this past Shabbat. He sits down, he can't go further. And they call upon Rabbi Gerelich to speak. And there's Rabbi Gerelich picks up exactly where Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg left off, the exact Gemara, the exact question, the exact topic, and develops this beautiful talk he had prepared. And when he finishes, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov embraces him and says, what a yashakayach, you deserve it from me, a reishkecha. It's exactly what I wanted to speak about, exactly what I wanted to say. And Rabbi Gerelich, wow, a sigh of relief, but another wonderful story about the Rebbe. Okay, close the parentheses. It's right there in the sources I gave you. You'll see the story as related by Rabbi Avram Avra Weingart, who heard the story from Rabbi Gerelich of Milano. All right, let's come back to the seventh Rebbe. No question, his father, Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, his years, if I didn't give them to you, 1878 to 1944, was the greatest influence on his life. This was his role model. His father was Rav in a number of Ukrainian cities. Finally, he comes to Yekaterinoslav in 1909. He's there for 30 good years before he's arrested for teaching religion. He winds up in exile. He goes through hell the last years of his life. And finally, he's released. He goes to Almaty, where he was warmly welcomed. There was a small Lubavitcher community. It's a warmer climate. And with all the agnes nefesh and all the aggravation, he dies buried in a forgotten area. Today, of course, it's been revised, his grave. There's a Chabad synagogue within striking distance. And this was the Rebbe's father. His mother, who married his father in 1900, Hannah, you all know that she survived the Holocaust, survived the communist, finally was released. The Rebbe was, I believe, the only time he left America after he emigrated to America, went to Paris to be with his mother, to bring her to the United States. And his mother lived some very beautiful years in the United States, wrote a beautiful memoir, which was published in installments by Chabad, translated into English. I believe they're coming out with a book. Am I right, Alex, that that's going to be published as a full book? It's a beautiful memoir of the family, of the Rebbe's father, of the Rebbe, a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. Now, what type of life did they have? Who taught him? His father, fine, was the leading figure in his life. But a person has to go to school. In the city where his father was Rav, there was tremendous machloket. When the previous rabbi died, the community actually split in half. and they elected two different rabbanim. Mm. Rabbi Pinchas Gelman, who was the Litvish Rav, was a Mizrachiite. And the Rebbe's father was the Hasidic Rav and a non-Mizrachiite. And the community was so split that they couldn't agree upon one rabbi. It was the first time that they actually split in half and had two different rabbanim. Now, the Rebbe went to Cheder. And the Rebbe, as we said, had family living there. Part of the family was religious, part of the family wasn't religious. Already in the very early years, the Rebbe was out of a, what would we call it, an igloo, a tent, a vacuum. He was exposed to so many different influences. And here we come to some beautiful memoir literature. One of the most famous Israeli poets was Avraham Shlansky. Avraham Shlansky, who won Pras Yisrael in his world. He had a sister, Verdina. It's not ancient history. When I came in Aliyah, these people were still active and very well known, were interviews in the newspapers. Verdina Shlansky was a great musician. She won Pras Yisrael in the field of music, composer. These people were the Rebbe's cousins. And they grew up together. Both of them left memoir literature. And you have literally a picture, a portrait of the Rebbe as a youngster growing up. I now quote from Avraham Shlansky. After the infamous pogroms of 1905, we moved from Kryukov to Yekarskanilov. I lived for a number of years in the same apartment building as my relatives, the family of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson. Our apartments were right next to each other, and I studied in the same class with the oldest of the Schneerson children, Mendel. We called him Mecca. Yomo, Mecca, is that a Russian word? What's the slang? How does Menachem become Mecca? Recognize it? No. Mecca. We were taught by our teacher, Rabbi Zalman de Scheichet. We spent many hours of the day together. Besides learning, I also spent many hours in his house. This is the poet Shlansky, Avraham Shlansky speaking. I really loved my relatives' Chabad home atmosphere. I remember that one day I decided that the kashrut in my own house wasn't up to par, and I began to weed only at my Aunt Hannah's house. Aunt Hannah was the Rebbe's mother. We were relocated to a different part of town. However, my contact with my cousin remained very close. At my bar mitzvah, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak presented me with a Tanya as a gift. Mendel, the Rebbe, was very quiet and reserved. He was interested in astronomy. Maps hung on the walls of his room showing the positions of the planets. Now notice this last description of the Rebbe. It confirms what my Talmud Chaver, Rabbi David Holzer, writes about in quoting the Rav. What is the word called? Where he quotes the Rav. The Rav Thinking Aloud, right? Yeah, the Rav Thinking Aloud, I believe, is the name of the work. So the Rav too comments that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, whom we knew in Berlin, was quiet, reticent, withdrawn. The last person in the world the Rav would have imagined would become the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe, outgoing, talking to everyone, standing on his feet for hours, giving out dollar bills, giving out brachot. When he still had yechidah, the lad, all night, talking, people, every walk of life, every type of Jew. And he says exactly what David Holzer quotes the Rav, very quiet and reserved. Notice the interest in science. You see, we saw this before, we see it again. He had an interest in general knowledge. Shlomsky never lost contact with the Rebbe. In fact, in 1968, Shlomsky came to New York to visit the Rebbe, and the Rebbe tried hard to rekindle the flame of Judaism in his cousin. Shlomsky wrote a few poems describing the confusion of his youth. His grandfather on the Shlomsky side of the family was an atheist, while his great-grandfather on his mother's side was a famed Hasidic rabbi. Avram Shlomsky was named after his great-grandfather, the Rebbe. In one poem, Shlomsky writes, quote, "On my father's bookshelf self sat the Tanya, leaning on the book of Pushkin." Although the Rebbe and his cousin had two different lifestyles, they had mutual respect for each other. The Rebbe once said to his cousin during his trip to New York, quote, "You and I both had a deep-seated belief in God. I express it through Torah and mitzvot, while you express it through your poetry." And very deep. So you see, it also shows you right here that the Rebbe in his youth is exposed to different types of people. When you came to the Rebbe, you could be Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Atheist, Agnostic, purely secular. Nothing shocked the Rebbe. This is not the present Gerer Rebbe. The present Gerer Rebbe, I've told you more than once, will only talk to people who are Shomer Shabbos. He will not meet with anyone who is not Shomer Shabbos, the present Gerer Rebbe. And I'm not being critical, I'm stating a fact. He's entitled to his viewpoint. I can understand it. My wife feels like that at times. I understand it. I understand it very well. But the Rebbe could deal with anyone and anything, because look who his cousin is, Avram Shlomsky, Verdina Shlomsky. Now Verdina, and you got to see, all this is sourced by Deutsch. This I'm quoting to you from the volume I quoted before, Larger Than Life. All this is sourced. Shlomsky's younger sister Verdina was an accomplished pianist and composer. She was the first woman composer in Israel and winner of the Prize for Compositions in Paris, 1932. Her memories of the Rebbe are recorded in an article entitled "The Rebbe in His Youth." And again, this is the sister now. I remember the Rebbe as a quiet child. Interesting, interesting. "He had a high forehead, a serious face, and sharp eyes." Again, already in youth, he's learning day and night. Life, he's serious. "As children, we refer to him by his nickname, Mecca." Again, Mecca comes up. Anyone here, Russian speakers, Mecca. "As times, we also called him Mendela." Mendela. And it is very important. This is what the Rebbe said when his wife died. I'll never forget it. That no one is left who calls me Mendel. You follow? And there's a lot behind that statement. Because sometimes we have a way of becoming too big for our breeches. We think, who knows who we are? Who knows what we've accomplished in life? Nothing was greater for me every morning when I walked in to see my mother and she said, "Ani, good morning, how are you?" Ani, underline the Ani. "At times, we also called him Mendela. I was the youngest of six children in my family. Our family was very close with our cousins, the Schneersons. We both lived in the same apartment building. In fact, both of our families lived on the ground floor. Only a wall separated our apartments. The dividing wall served not only to separate our living quarters, but also our lifestyles. To me, Chana and Levi Yitzchak Schneerson were like a king and a queen. They were so beautiful, astute, musically proficient, and pure. Chana always dressed elegantly. She loved socializing with friends. Reb Levitt, nicknamed for Levi Yitzchak, was a tall and handsome man with a beard that had the same shape as Herzl. Their children were beautiful. Mendel was older than me. However, I remembered him well. He was interested in learning about everything. The adults would say that he was proficient in many fields. He was an unusual child. Then there was his youngest brother, Luba, nicknamed for Yisrael Ayeleib, Luba, that you do recognize in Russian. Although he resembled his older brother, the Rebbe, both in features and intellect, his mannerisms were very different. I spent many hours with them. At times, our parents would go shopping together and leave us home alone. They would put all of us in the same room when we would sit down and play. We played together a lot, both in our front garden and backyards. Since both of our families lived on the ground floor, we would at times climb out of a window from one apartment to another. While the adults used the doors as means of entrance, we used the windows. That's fabulous. Could you imagine Art Scroll writing of a book about Reb Chaim Isaac Wyszynski climbing out of the windows? There'd be haramim from here to China. But you see, the Rebbe, he could relate to a little child. He could relate to a young adult. He lived. The beautiful description. Kids, and kids have to play. You all remember my chesped and Joe DiMaggio. My quote from the Meitzer Tiluy. I began the chesped with the Meitzer, and 3 hours later, I ended the chesped with the Meitzer. It was Mamish Adon Olam, Adon Olam. It's exactly, kids have to play. Although our home wasn't religious, Hasidus has a major impact in our lives. My father was a professor and taught us Hebrew to enrich our knowledge. He instilled in us the desire to acquire as much knowledge as possible. And this is beautiful description. And she describes her relationship with her uncle, with the Rebbe's father, and she describes Havdalah in the Schneerson house. When I think of the Rebbe, I think of Mecca, Belka, and Luba. Those are the three boys. I think of the hall in our apartment building that always had an echo. I think of the faith, hope for the future, deep-seated emotions, songs of victory, and the mutual influence that our families had in each other. This is what I think and miss. And you see here, too, if we only know, every Jew, and Hasidus, it's the nail on the head, every Jew has that kernel, has that garin, has that nucleus. We have to know how to dig it out, how to get at it. What did the Rav always say? We have to inspire our students with the romance of being part of the Torah people. And that's the challenge that all of us as mechanchim face. The romance. If a kid will feel that feeling of romance, his Yiddishkeit will come naturally. He will not leave it. He will not do it as a b'dievet. He will not treat it as something light, secondary importance. This is the great challenge to us. And here you have a woman who is not that religious, and it's later in life, and she's a general Zionist, probably a Mapainik, but the roots are there. The tragedy is, of course, the children grow up without the roots, totally lost. But still, a Jew studied with the Malach. Within him, there is the seeds, the kernels. We can inspire him. The last part of what I want to do, I won't finish today, but I'll start it and we'll leave the heart of it for next week, Bezrat Hashem. I wouldn't miss next week for anything. I just need the ability to teach it without becoming a flood of tears, because I'm going to compare the Rebbe to the Rav on a certain level. Coming back to youth, so I can tell you just a small comment. I think I told you yesterday that Thursday morning some arm of Chabad is coming here to set up all their sophisticated modern equipment and to interview yours truly on the Rav and the Rebbe. I think it's a fallout of my article in Jewish Action. So I told him I want the interview to be in the office, because I said my office is like a museum with all that's up in the walls. Part of what I want to see if I can drive it home, if you look at the pictures on the wall in my office, most of the pictures are pictures you would expect to see, pictures of Rabbanim, pictures of Israel, pictures of the army, etc., etc., pictures of Russia, where we worked so diligently during the decade of the 80s. And on the other side of the wall are pictures of the New York Yankees, Joe DiMaggio, the 27 Yankees, the new stadium, which is a picture I actually took. And those pictures are important. Why are they important? So when a student meets with his Rebbe, the student should understand that the Rebbe grew up in this world. He wasn't an angel deposited from on high without the strivings, the quests, the challenges that we all face growing up in a big world that's not only Torah, but Torah and Western, and has so many different values and commitments on both sides of the coin. So that's, to me, the image of the Rebbe as a child jumping out of the window. If there's an artist here, I challenge him to do a picture of these Schneerson Schlansky children playing, and one of them jumping from one property to another through the window. And now, one step further. The Rebbe did not have a narrow formal education. The educational system or facilities in the town where he grew up, there already was, as I mentioned, an enlightened school system, which was, on one hand, religious, or at least had a commitment to religion, and the other hand was committed to a regular high school, to a regular gymnasium, to a Zionist outlook, etc. And the Rebbe had a private tutor who his father brought from the high school. The name of the tutor was Yisrael Eidelson. Now, this Yisrael Eidelson later becomes very famous in the state of Israel. He became a great Mapai leader. He was a Sab in Memshelet Yisrael under a different name, Yisrael Bar Yehuda. When I came in Aliyah, I knew the name very well. And he tells the following story. He told this to one of the Chabad Rabbanim in the state of Israel, Rabbi Tuvia Blau. Quote, "One day, the Rebbe met me, he's a young man, high school age, and told me that his father had instructed him to study secular subjects as well. The conditions which his father set were that he was required to study the Hebrew subjects for 16 hours a day. The other 8 hours he could use in order to study secular subjects, eat, and sleep. I asked the Rebbe if he was willing to accept his father's terms. His answers were definitely yes. And I organized appropriate lessons and tutors for him." We spoke about this last week. This was Yisrael Bar Yehuda, who his father puts in charge of giving special lessons to the Rebbe and his youngest brother. And this by Yehuda described, the rivalry between the brother and the Rebbe extended to their study of foreign languages. They both completed and studied hard with the aid of foreign language dictionaries. Their mother once related that on one occasion, the Rebbe translated a document from English to Russian, saving the official city translator from much embarrassment and possibly his job, since he did not know English well enough. And I want to tell you, if you think that this is not possible, you know, we all had to pick up various languages. I was born, obviously, my native language is English. My parents were born in Holland. They only spoke English to me. But although one set I think I spoke English to, one set, one grandfather I barely spoke with because he worked by night and slept by day. But his language was Yiddish. But I had to pick up Yiddish in yeshiva in seventh grade and in elementary school because my teachers were Shanghai survivors. So we picked up Yiddish. How did we pick up Yiddish? We picked up by hearing it being spoken. I never studied Yiddish to read it. I never studied Yiddish in that sense. I never studied Yiddish. All right, I mastered a little reading. I mastered the ayin, the aleph, all that goes with Yiddish compared to Hebrew. Later, communist Yiddish was very fascinating to me. But and then, of course, you have to pick up Hebrew. How did you pick up Hebrew? All right, Hebrew, you read more, you learned more, you picked up in the Akiva in my days. You come in Aliyah, of course. Nowadays, you can live in Israel all your life, and then you can get along in Hebrew, you can get along in French, you can get along in Russian. But more or less, the children, Kanai and Hara, who have to serve in the army and protect us, ultimately pick up Hebrew and take it further. But picking up a language from a dictionary? Could you picture the Rebbe and his brother going through an English dictionary? So I want to tell you, my wife's father, who came to America, builds a Hasidic Yingel in his teen years, right after World War I. My wife's grandfather fought in World War I, was a medic, a Hasidic Belzel Yingel, mit Preyes and Alts. And I want to tell you, he learned English and he learned Hebrew, autodidactic. You know how we learned English? Going through a dictionary, word by word by word. So when I hear this about the Rebbe, it's not a Hasidic story. I accept it as an absolute fact. My father-in-law used to subscribe to Hadoah. You remember what Hadoah was? The Hebrew weekly in the United States. And he went through it with a Hebrew-English dictionary till he understood every word. So it is possible. But as far as the Rebbe goes, the best is yet to come. And Be'ezrat Hashem, as far as his youth goes, we're going to talk about his Rebbe in Cheder. We're going to talk about the Rav and his Rebbe in Cheder. And we're going to talk about the unbelievable influence that these giants of giants, the impression upon these giants in their youth that ultimately reaches out and affects hundreds of thousands, in the Rebbe's case it could even be millions already, of Torah Jews as a result of two Rabbeim in Cheder. Never forget the influence of a teacher. Rakefet quotes in Washington, quoting someone else, but quoting a very powerful quote, that the influence of a teacher is eternal. So let me reiterate, what did we do today? Right, a little different than yesterday. I have to tell you, with yesterday's shiur, I just wrote to someone who had corresponded with me that you take Eastern Parkway. If the Chazon Ish is right, it's the easiest area in the world in which to build an Erev. Have you ever been to Eastern Parkway? You ever seen the buildings on the side of Eastern Parkway? Wow! Mechitza Gemura. And if Reb Moshe is right, who, as you all know from my Shiurim, has trouble understanding Chazon Ish, There's no harder place to build an Erev than Eastern Parkway. 600,000 people going by daily, perhaps, with all that's involved. Today's shiur was, on one hand, a little harder to give because of the emotion. On the other hand, a more beautiful picture to paint of little children playing, influence, growing up. The Rebbe, silent, reticent, his father, the influence of his father, the hatmada, the learning, the science, the knowledge, the cousins, the problems already, the exposure to different viewpoints, to Bolshevikism, to communism, his own brother, the exposure to Zionism, pure Zionism, not Torah Zionism. Wow, what a world. Now let's move further. Rabbi Rubin causes heartache throughout the Chabad world. They pick up his comments. So Yitz, you have correspondence for you. There never was a Nisar in Chabad regarding going to the Museum of Natural History. Chabad believes in existence of dinosaurs. Just how different, has different views as to how old they were. And here are letters from the Rebbe dealing with the very problems that Rabbi Rubin raised. By the way, Rabbi Asher Weiss is in Chutz Lavis. He didn't give shiur last week, so there's nothing. What you can find on the websites is beyond my comprehension. You all recall that I mentioned the Munkacher wedding and the Rebbe talking about Shabbos, hidden, halt Shabbos, halt Shabbos. A Talmud Chaim Schnitzer sends me a printout, you can check it out, that yes, the royal wedding, this was a news item in 1933, that Fox filmed the wedding, the Rebbe got 100,000 Czech kronen for his cooperation in the production of the Rebbe. This fact was utilized by Hasidic opponents as a weapon against the Rebbe, and a vigorous campaign was waged against him. Rabbi Spiro thereupon requested the film company to destroy the film in question. When they refused to do this, the Rebbe issued a ban and forbade any Jew to go and see it. The film company thereupon brought an action against the Rebbe, demanding that he either remove the ban or reimburse the very large sums which they claimed to have expended upon the production of the film. Can anyone check this out and see whether it was ever resolved? But take a look, a simple matter like that movie, and the world is shaking. This is a talk given by someone who has a PhD dealing with the story of Torah in America. It totally leaves out anything before Mr. Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. Someone asked me to comment on it. All I could comment was, this is someone who graduated in Israel who asked me to comment. My comment was very simple. In 50 years, there will be books written in the Art Scroll framework which will state, as a matter of fact, that Rabbi Dov Lipman is a graduate of Yeshiva University and studied in the Gris Kollel. And the worst part is that people will believe it. Read it. Tell me your reaction. Let me go one step further. This is an interview with Rabbi Yonatan Weiner. He teaches in Ar Sameach in Yerushalayim, and it's about his visit with the Rebbe, with his father, Yechidut, many, many years ago. And his father is a world-famous medical doctor who has great achievements, and he's discussing medicine with the father, discussing innovations he invented, and he describes his father talking with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe talking with his father as if they were both world-famous medical professors. It's amazing the knowledge that the Rebbe had. It's a very fascinating interview. This is an article that just appeared in the New York Times, Christians Loving Israel. It deals with but with the Netanyahu's visit to America. Very fascinating reading, and I've met some of these Christians, and I can tell you, halavai, some of our Jews, I'm talking about Frum Jews in Borough Park and Flatbush and Squaretown, etc., would have their understanding of what Eretz Yisrael is about. Finally, very sad news for the world, not for me individually, Borsalina going bankrupt. So anyone who's smart, invest now in a hat company and just set it up to produce Chassidische hats or hats for YU people, black and whites, as my Talmud who breaks my heart tells me, and you make a good living. And finally, next to last, an article that I couldn't believe from the New York Times, how the Yankee stars break in their gloves. Rodriguez keeps his glove overnight in the freezer. Jason, you know anything about baseball? The difference between a first baseman's glove, a third baseman's glove, a catcher's glove, and thus they do and what they do. Halavai, we take care of our tefillin the way they take care of their baseball gloves. Finally, I spoke about this yesterday. I mentioned it again from the Panim Chadashot that are here. I'm very proud of this. I have a share in it. No? Morty, you're wondering, what's the Rebbe saying? He has a share in this? Come on, cut it out. No, I have a share. This beautiful Megillah with the illustration, I just sent a letter to the fundraiser for Shvut Ami to what to do with this. That beautiful Megillah was put together by a Shvut Ami graduate, a Russian young man from Leningrad, studied in the Russian Institute of Art, came in Aliyah, became Frum, I don't know, there, here, studied in Shvut Ami, and he's the one who made that Megillah, which our Prime Minister gave so proudly to Representative Boehner. So Baruch Hashem. But now this has to be turned into fundraising for Shvut Ami. There's a lot of work to do in the Ukrainian and bringing kids over in Taglit. We're running all types of programs for Russian kids. The Ribbono Shel Olam should give us strength, because on this level, I quote the Rav, when it comes to reaching out, is the Rav, the famous interview in Mariv that Rakefet quotes from the article in Jewish Action that achieved so much attention, because no one else remembered that interview, that whole thing at YU, everyone knows, at the Rav Holzman, the people care, people here, this one, that one here, family arguing, but the Rav, you don't have to go to anyone, the Rav is speaking, he didn't have any reason to lie to Mariv. But in that beautiful interview, the Rav says, when it comes to reaching out in the college campuses, I totally agree with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and every Jew has within him a spark. We just, Rafi, I'm counting on you to be smart enough to know how to reach the spark in 90% of the cases. We can't succeed 100%. You understand what I'm saying? But 90%, I'm counting on you and Shashi. My dear students, next Sunday and Monday, classes as normal. Beyond that, we'll figure out what's happening in the Kollel, because a great Chag is coming along to interfere with the normal course of events. It is known as Pesach or Chag HaMatzot. You understand? The Jew calls it Pesach because we praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu who Pasach al Habatim. He didn't kill us. He only killed the Egyptians. The Ribbono Shel Olam calls it Chag HaMatzot. Credit me, Kamcha Yisrael Goyachad Baretz. Credit to the Jewish people, because we baked matzah and existed on it for many, many days. That was our sustenance until the manna. We went into a desert. We didn't have a caterer with us, but we were semich on a Kaddish Baruch Hu. So there's a machlokes between us, who and which is more important. Is it Pesach or Chag HaMatzot? Perhaps it's the synthesis of the two. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. By the way, my Sunday class be Rabbi Schwab. Next week I pick up Rabbi Schwab. We don't let any Jew escape. Everyone fits into the picture. Anyone want my last Chafetz Chaim picture?
I
have it right now. Yeah, no, this is good.
I listen.
You want to get
all the time.
I saw it on the internet.
No, you can hang it, you can frame it, this is... Ugh.
You sent
there
was one where
there were
names.
Yes, Yomo. Yomo, you know Yomo. He sent me the links.
I've been hearing about Yomo for a long time.
I won't be here. I should visit my mother this week for a week. Oh. So I'll be back after this. But it's not going to be a shiur in 2 weeks?
I don't know. I have to find out from... you'll check with Morty. I'll know next week. I have to check with them. I don't think Monday. I don't know Sunday, but it may be Sunday. I'll hold the press conference. I'll do something different. If they're around, I have to find out. But let's leave it to next week. Because I find if I say I'm not going to be here 2 weeks from now, next week already. Rabbi, I thought you were in Chicago. You understand? Have a good trip. So how long are you going for?
Just for 6 days.
6 days. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Everything should be good. And is your father-in-law back yet?
No, he's coming back in 2 weeks.
So your wife going or?
No, she's teaching.
Teaching. No, I understand. Kivalti, that's my wife's complaint. She wants to go to Europe, wants to go. So limit how much I can harm my students, even if, you know, at my stage of life, I can be more free with my time. But kachasa. Okay, 1 second. So we're starting next week. It's quite a class. Okay. Where's Aura?
Her sister came in last night from America, so she's doing a sister's day.
Next week she brings her sister here. What's her sister's name?
Goldsmith.
Her name's Andy. They didn't see the person. Cedarhurst. That's the story I tell in Cedarhurst with Alan Dershowitz's mother. It was in Young Israel. Young Israel. Like, this is
just beat it really good.
Yeah, there's the story.
She's friends with my wife's grandma. My wife's grandma used to tell her he sent a limo to pick her up at the borough park. And my wife always pointed out, yes, what were your children called?
It's a sad story with Alan Dershowitz. What could have been. But it's Musa to a Rebbeim. You don't tell off a student. You don't tell off a student.
On the other hand, right, what the Rebbe was explained, was it yesterday, 2 years ago, about how Zionism had to start with the non-from people.
Oh, yeah, no, that's...
If Dershowitz was somebody who stood up there and would talk with a Strimel and a Kapata who would listen to him, at least he backs Israel. So people, you know, where he is, people listen to him.
It's food for thought.
But if you don't, I don't understand. We have to.
No, I
have to spend. Nevertheless, it wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, no, that's. There's personal levels and global levels.
I heard Bennett speak. His English is perfect. I thought he was slightly accent. He'll be very good. I only hope we see good results. Yeah. Right. I heard an. I didn't hear an accent. Right. Listen, you don't make hundreds of millions of dollars being a jerk. So you understand there.